You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. In this podcast, Slate magazine editor Dahlia Lithwick recaps highlights from the Supreme Court's last term, previews the new term, and talks about the current big themes. Dahlia Lithwick is a senior editor at Slate magazine and, in that capacity, writes the Supreme Court dispatches and jurisprudence columns. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Harper's, The New Yorker, The Washington Post, and Commentary, among other places. Ms. Lithwick spoke at the Friday, November 13, 2015 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV President Bob McGrath. Our podcast is entitled Update on the Supreme Court. Here's Bob McGrath.
Today, it's my great pleasure to introduce our speaker, Dahlia Lithwick. Now, as most of us know, she's a very, very well-known journalist and commentator on the Supreme Court and other judicial and legal matters. She's a senior editor at Slate and writes the Supreme Court dispatches and jurisprudence columns for that magazine. Her work appears in every publication worth knowing about. Just a short list, the New York Times, Harper's, The New Yorker, The Washington Post, Commentary, The Atlantic, The New Republic, and as I say, there must be others that I don't have time to list. She's testified before Congress about access to justice in the Roberts era court. She's appeared on and appears often on CNN, ABC, MSNBC, and even The Colbert Report, where she more than held her own. She has a bachelor's degree from Yale and a law degree from Stanford. She clerked for a justice of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit and practiced family law before turning to reporting and analyzing legal issues. We're grateful that she finds a way to fit Senior Statesman of Virginia into her very crowded schedule. Today is the third time she's taking time to give us a report on the latest goings-on of the court. So today, we're in exactly the right place at exactly the right time to learn the latest on the Supreme Court, what happened last term, what's likely to happen this term, and what are the current big themes in the court. Please welcome Dahlia Lithwick.
Thank you so much. I'm going to move this a little bit. Can you all hear me? Can people in the back? Okay. Is it low enough? Really? You know, when Elena Kagan used to argue at the court, she used to have to jack the mic like so for 10 minutes of, yeah.
Last time you were here, in my defense, the last time you were here, the mic was way up here and you spent all the time trying to.
That's why I'm wearing 2-inch heels. So we are just fine. I just want to thank you all for coming out. This has become such a cherished event for me, and I want to thank Bob. I want to thank my dear friend Grace Zisk, who, no matter what happens, is just until she gets a yes from me, she's just like a terrifying little pit bull. So, and I really want to thank the Senior Center and the Senior Statesman for bringing me here. And just by way of a shout out, Jesse Rutledge, who's coming in December, is a good friend and a tremendous, tremendous thinker on state courts. And so I commend to you, come to his event. You should all come back. So I'm going to talk about last term at the court, this coming term at the court, big trends and themes. I'm going to try to leave heaps of times for questions with the caveat that I really have to pick up my son at 3:30, so heaps is slightly constrained by the fact that I can't leave him standing at school. There's just a tremendous amount of material here, and you all over the years have been amazing about just stopping me. If I'm saying something that's so far in the weeds that you don't know what I'm talking about, just fling up your arm and say, you know, I don't know what ERISA is, at which point I will tell you I don't know what ERISA is either. But, you know, if I'm confounding you with jargon, which I will try not to do, let me know. So I thought I'd sort of divide my remarks into two parts. The first is recapping last term at the U.S. Supreme Court, which was really, I think, a monumentally important and interesting term, not just for the, you know, one case everybody talked about, which was marriage equality, but for a lot of really important and interesting trends and themes. And then I'll try to pivot to this coming term, which just started this October, again with the caveat that the court hasn't docketed the whole term. We only actually have cases docketed through the winter. So we don't know exactly what's coming up in the spring, and it's very possible that were I to come back here in January, we'd have a lot more to talk about. And then I'll try to end by sort of talking about the presidential election and the stakes with regard to the Supreme Court, which I don't suspect I need to say much more than that about, which is there's a presidential election coming, and four of the justices are either 80 or over, or will be 80 by next year. So I think we're going to see a sea change in the next 4 or 5 years, and it's certainly something that we should be talking about a lot more than we are. So with that as my very ambitious plan, let's start with just as quick a recap as we can do of the 2014 term that ended in June of 2015. And I'm going to not do every case. I'm going to try to do the 7 or 8 big significant ones and use each of them to highlight some trend or idea. So one of the cases that was decided on the very last day of the term last year had to do with lethal injection. And the case was Glossop versus Gross. And at the simplest level, this was actually just a really technical challenge about the drugs that we use in most states in the 3-drug protocol when we execute a capital prisoner. But it turned into a huge, huge case that didn't get a lot of attention because there were other cases that came down that week. But it turned into a really monumental debate at the court about whether we can continue with the capital punishment system as it exists today. So in brief, Oklahoma is one of many, many states that uses a 3-drug cocktail in order to execute its capital prisoners. And one of those, and it's become very, very hard for the states to get their hands on these lethal injection drugs. Increasingly problematic, partly because of boycotts here, partly because the European Union does not allow drugs to come into the United States to be used for capital punishment. And so states are doing a lot of crazy things in order to procure drugs. And one of the things they do is they turn to these compounding pharmacies who sort of make drugs on the side. It's like the moonshine of the lethal injection world. But, you know, one of the things they do is they use experimental protocols that have not necessarily been tested. And unfortunately, they use them on live human subjects. And we know from Oklahoma last year, from the Clayton Lockett execution, that there have been horrific botched executions where prisoners, you know, lay and writhe on the gurney for a half an hour, scream, "I'm on fire." We've had a whole series of these because the drug protocol doesn't work. And Oklahoma, one of the 3 drugs in the protocol is called midazolam. I may be pronouncing it wrong. Doctors tell me if it's midazolam, but we say both things on television, and we just hope nobody notices. But one of the 3 drugs in the cocktail was challenged by a bunch of prisoners who said, this doesn't have the effect it's supposed to have. It suppresses our ability to scream out that we're in pain, but we're in fact experiencing horrific torture. This case comes to the Supreme Court really just as a challenge to the use of this one drug. And by a 5-4 margin on the last day of the term, Justice Sam Alito, writing for the majority, which is the block of conservative judges, upholds the use of this drug, basically on the theory that since capital punishment is constitutional, we know that it's written into the Constitution, then there has to be a constitutional way to do it. And this is it. This is good enough. And Justice Sonia Sotomayor, writing for the 4 dissenters, the 4 liberal justices in dissent, says this is crazy. The evidence that they were using in this trial that midazolam works came from drugs.com. This is not the way we figure out whether a drug works. There's a factual dispute on the record as to whether these prisoners are in excruciating pain. We can't allow this to go forward. 5-4, it goes forward. The only reason this is interesting is because Justice Stephen Breyer, in dissent, so he's one of the four liberal justices who can't sign off on this, does something that we haven't seen at the court in decades. He writes a dissent only signed by him and Ruth Bader Ginsburg saying, no, I'm done. I'm done with capital punishment. The whole thing is probably unconstitutional. And then he appends this massive brief where he just says, as it's practiced today in the United States, we're doing capital punishment unconstitutionally. It's always going to violate the Eighth Amendment ban on cruel and unusual punishment. Therefore, I am asking the world to bring me a case, bring me a challenge where we can get rid of the death penalty altogether. And it's an amazing moment. Justice Scalia kind of went after him at the announcement of the opinion, sort of saying that he doesn't believe in law, he doesn't believe in anything. But it was an invitation by two members of the court. We haven't had a justice on the court in a long time, certainly in my career, who simply felt, as a foundational matter, that we can't do lethal injection constitutionally. We're one of a handful of countries that still does it. And so this was a real sea change. This was Justice Breyer saying to litigators out there, I'm asking you to come to me with a global challenge to capital punishment. And so I think there's some belief that there's at least two justices who are really receptive now to the kinds of arguments that say this is racially imbalanced, this is geographically unfair, there are too many reasons to do away with it. And so I think looking forward, we're going to see whether litigants really listen to that invitation and start to bring absolutely foundational challenges to the practice of capital punishment. The other case you probably heard of, we talked about it here last year, was the big Obamacare challenge. Now, there's almost no point in saying the big Obamacare challenge because we're about to hit our fourth this term at the court. But King versus Burwell, as you recall, was another big effort to pretty much dismantle the Affordable Care Act. The states that did not create exchanges came to the courts and said, we do not agree with the proposition that in states that don't have insurance exchanges, the federal exchange can stand in as a substitute. And so in any state where you didn't have an insurance exchange, you could get on healthcare.gov, and you could, even in the absence of a state exchange, purchase health insurance. So millions and millions of Americans enroll on the federal exchange. And the claim before the court is no. Obamacare didn't anticipate that the federal government would step in where the states didn't create exchanges. Why? Because the clear language of the statute, you could probably all say this with me, is exchanges established by the states. And what that means, the plain meaning of established by the states, is that the states create their own exchanges, not the federal government, the states. And therefore, the federal government the federal government's effort to insert itself into this process is clearly not just on the plain language of the statute impermissible, but it's also arrogating power that belongs to the states. And this was a huge, huge fight at the court. We were at some level arguing about the words established by the states, but I think everybody knew that if the 36 states that didn't have exchanges were all bounced off the federal exchange, we would have had what's called a death spiral, and it would have been functionally the end of the Affordable Care Act. In a very, very surprising decision, it wasn't 5-4, it was 6-3, with John Roberts and Anthony Kennedy joining with the court's liberal wing to really throw away that notion that those five words in the statute could somehow usurp the entire purpose of Congress in creating the ACA. And so the majority opinion in King versus Burwell, written by the Chief Justice John Roberts, more or less says, look, the purpose of this statute was to provide insurance. It makes no sense that the statute has language written in that would eviscerate the very intent of Congress. Anthony Kennedy signs on. Justice Antonin Scalia goes berserk. And the dissenters in this case really feel that this is the end of plain meaning in words and statutes. Really, Scalia's dissent in this says words no longer have meaning. Words no longer have meaning, but Obamacare lives to see yet another day. Now, the big, big case that you all probably know enough about that I don't have to spend too much time is the marriage equality cases. And these are the ones that I think suck up all the oxygen to the point that we didn't talk about much else last summer. In brief, at that point, we had 36 states that had signed off on the possibility that you could have a same-sex marriage. Other states, either by way of referendum or judicial fiat, had said, no, we're banning gay marriage. So really the only question was whether the states that did not want to allow gay marriage could be forced to do so, whether there was going to be a universal standard around the country that said, of course, we have a constitutional right to marriage equality. In a surprise to not many people, Anthony Kennedy, who is the swing vote on the court but has also voted on the side of expansive gay rights in every case that he has heard on the court, threw his lot in with the liberals on the court and said, of course, we're going to allow same-sex couple, the word he used was dignity and equality that we allow opposite sex couples to have. And so in a 5-4 decision on the second last day of the term, Obergefell comes down and says, there is now a constitutional right in every state to marry someone of the same sex. Now, I think a lot of progressives who were hoping that that case would be written in a clear and crystalline fashion so that going forward we could understand the level of scrutiny, whether this is equal protection, whether this is due process, what the test was going to be for other gay civil rights litigation, were horribly disappointed. Because Justice Kennedy wrote the most beautiful Hallmark card ever written, but there's just not a lot of doctrine in it. And, you know, huge chunks of his majority opinion are used in marriage ceremonies, and it's very touching, but nobody knows exactly what the law is. And that's really been frustrating for people who were hoping to get clarification on other issues that had to do with gay rights in America. It's going to have to wait another day. I just want to flag for you that when people say to me, which they often do, oh, my God, why couldn't Elena Kagan write that opinion? Why didn't Justice Ginsburg write that opinion so that we could get clarity, we could get doctrinal rules, something very, very crisp? The answer is because this was Kennedy's legacy. This was the thing that Anthony Kennedy had been waiting to do for a long time. This is the thing that he will tell his great-grandchildren about. And the liberals on the court made the decision not to concur in that case. Nobody wrote on the left side of the court to say, here's what he really meant. They just let him be, and the case stands for the proposition that we're going to have to wait and see in other gay rights contexts what the law is going to become. So he didn't push things forward in that sense, but I think what he did in terms of using the language of dignity and the language of respect and equality was really, I think, quite clearly a historical moment. I should also point out, having pointed out, that there were no concurrences. Nobody on the left side of the court wrote to amplify or clarify what he did. There were 4 dissents. Every one of the people who dissented wrote a separate dissent in that case to say how completely wrong-headed Kennedy's opinion was. And I think, as I'm going to say in a moment, that's very emblematic of the difference this term at the court was that the left wing of the court that doesn't always hang together, hung together. The right wing of the court that has typically done a pretty good job of working in tandem and not undermining each other, in this and other areas, they were so frustrated that they sometimes worked at cross purposes. So Obergefell goes on to be the case that I think we all talk about, but there are a whole bunch of other cases that got a little bit lost in the shuffle. One of them that's really important is an Arizona case that had to do with whether you could create a nonpartisan redistricting commission. So we all know that the way we do our legislative districting is so grossly dysfunctional that we work and we get nothing done. In Arizona, and by the way, in California, they created nonpartisan bodies that would simply do the work in a nonpartisan fashion. And the challenge was brought by the Arizona State Legislature that said, no, this is clearly a legislative function. It's clearly something that has to be done by us in a 5-4 decision, again, the very, very last week of the term, written by Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The court upholds the possibility of using these nonpartisan redistricting commissions, opening the door to the other states that are experimenting with this, and making the point that, look, states are supposed to be the laboratories of democracy. This is the one thing that we let states do. We let them fix their problems at a deeply granular level in the hopes that they can model for other states what to do. Another big, big case that comes up right toward the end of the term has to do with housing discrimination. This is a case that comes up through the state of Texas. It's called Texas Department of Housing versus Inclusive Communities. And this is a Texas group that is claiming that the poor populations who are supposed to be getting vouchers for housing are simply getting refused. Their vouchers are getting refused in all sorts of jurisdictions. And they can't prove that there's intentional discrimination, but the claim is that there is disparate impact, that there's a pattern, not of intentional discrimination, but the time and time and time again, it's these poor minority communities that get refused on their housing claims. And this is such an important case that went under the radar, because this whole notion of disparate impact in civil rights litigation has been eroded in other areas of the law. And I think that people thought the U.S. Supreme Court was taking this case in order to do away with the notion of disparate impact, to more or less say in these discrimination cases, unless you can show explicit intent to discriminate, you will always lose. And that's why we thought the court was taking the case. But in fact, by a 5-4 vote, again, Anthony Kennedy voting with the progressive bloc of the court, upheld the use of continuing to use the disparate impact test in housing discrimination cases, and actually doing something I haven't seen him do before, which is talk about subconscious bias for the first time, sort of saying we have to really think about how people discriminate. It's not simply that people intend to be racist. It's that sometimes these are deep subconscious impulses that we have to root out. And so if we can use the Fair Housing Act to do that, we will do it. But it really is the first time that we hear in an opinion the court talking about implicit and subconscious bias going forward. There's a big, big separation of powers case that gets turned into a referendum on Jerusalem. It's not, in fact, a referendum on Jerusalem. It's simply a case about who gets to set policy, government policy, about foreign affairs. So the issue is extremely technical, but basically the United States has been neutral on the subject of whether Jerusalem is the capital of Israel since the founding of the State of Israel. It's simply taken the position that we will not call Jerusalem the capital. We have our embassy in Tel Aviv. And we do that because we want to, in the interest of diplomacy, keep that question open. So that's been the executive branch policy. Congress felt otherwise. Congress passed a law. There was a signing statement by George Bush saying he objected to it. But Congress passed a law saying any Jewish citizen, any citizen who's born in Jerusalem, can say Jerusalem, comma, Israel on their passport. They can cite Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, even though the president doesn't agree that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. And Menachem Zivotofsky, born in 2002 in Jerusalem, Israel, to American parents, wants Jerusalem, comma, Israel on his passport. Not unreasonably, perhaps, but the State Department says no. Our policy is we put Jerusalem, it's not the capital of Israel. So this case has actually gone to and from the Supreme Court twice already. In 2012, on this question of who sets foreign policy, the president or Congress, the court kicked it back to the lower courts. It comes back again. Menachem Zivotofsky is almost of voting age now. But finally, we get to his court case on the merits, and the court actually surprised, I think, of a lot of us, in a 6-3 decision, they say this power belongs to the president. This power to determine foreign policy, the president gets a thumb on the scale, not the Congress. There was a trifecta of free speech cases that come down at the very, very end of the term. They're not hugely important, but I know we've talked about how this is a very, very speech-protective case court before, so I want to kind of circle the square there. The first one has to do with signs that had to do, this are called directional signs. There's a tiny little church in Gilbert, Arizona, and they move from place to place their Sunday services. And so the only way folks can know that there's church services is because the town puts up directional signs that say, this way, you know, to services this week. And there's a sign ordinance in Gilbert that says you can't do that. And 9-0, the court says, well, that clearly is wrong. You need to be able to put up direct that it's a violation of free speech to take these signs down. Elena Kagan, all nine of the justices agree, but Elena Kagan says, oh my God, going forward, we're going to spend our whole life scrutinizing municipal signs. Like, what did we just get involved in? And there's actually been huge fallout from this trivial little case where every sign is now subject to strict scrutiny as the test that the court uses, and now we're going to be litigating signs at the Supreme Court until Menachem Zivotofsky is ready to retire. Okay, the other one that I'm sure you heard of that was a really important speech case that, again, kind of went under the radar had to do with Confederate flag license plates. This was a Texas case, Walker versus Texas Division Sons of the Confederate Veterans. These are not vanity plates. These are plates that the states use to raise funds, and so they're complicated, right? But they are plates that have various political or sports teams or other beneficiaries, and Texas and many other states, nine other states, had Confederate flags on their license plates simply as a fundraiser, and after a notice and comment period, from people who profoundly objected to the Confederate flag on license plates, the case goes all the way up to the Supreme Court to determine whether your license plate is your speech or the state's speech. Is it closer to saying Texas is supporting these Confederate flags, or is it closer to saying Bob likes Confederate flags? And because it's unclear and ambiguous, this case goes all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court by a 5-4 margin, with amazingly Clarence Thomas jumping over to join the liberal members of the Roberts Court. The court says that Texas is free to reject those license plates. And this is going to play out. We're going to see it because, don't forget, we've got Choose Life signs. We've got all sorts of politically inflammatory license plates in all the states. So again, this is going to insert the court into determining which license plates are going to be permissible and which aren't. The last one I want to talk again about, because it's so important, we teed it up last year, and I think it was an important case, was a hate speech case. And this was Ilonis. This was a case that had to do with a Pennsylvania man who was using the internet, chiefly Facebook, to terrorize his ex-wife. And he was posting things on his Facebook page, on his sister-in-law's Facebook page. He was very mad. His wife took the kids and left him, and putting things up that looked a lot like he was threatening not just to kill her, but to go to a local kindergarten and shoot up children, threatening to harm co-workers. But Anthony Ilonis is a smart guy, and what he said was, I'm just a rapper. And these are rap lyrics, and this is a sort of, this is an homage, if you will, to Eminem the rapper, whose lyrics look a lot like these, and those are protected free speech. And he was very careful, by the way, whenever he put up a post threatening to kill his wife or his children, he would say, ha ha, this is me using my free speech. You know, he was very, very self-aware that he was pushing the boundaries of what is protected First Amendment speech. And the reason we talked about it at this event last year is because we really thought this was going to be the first, most important First Amendment test of whether the internet is different, of whether sort of shouting fire in a crowded theater is no longer the litmus test for unprotected speech, because now you can just shout fire in your basement in your pajamas on your Facebook page, and you can terrorize your wife six states away. And an awful lot of people, including the Obama Justice Department, came into this case on the side of the wife, saying, women are terrorized online every day, and there is an actual harm. These are not just words. There is an actual harm to having people threaten to kill you online. The court actually did not get to the First Amendment issue in this case, and they almost completely didn't touch the issue of whether rap music, which, by the way, has been used to jail and incarcerate people, their own, like, there is a whole amazing area of the law that is the law of rap music, because we protect opera lyrics, which can be violent. We protect, you know, Roadrunner and the Coyote, that's art. But there are rappers who are in jail because it looks like they were threatening to hurt or kill someone. And so there was this amazing series of rap briefs that went to the court, amicus briefs, that were trying to explain to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, age 83, the nature of rap music. But the court didn't touch that either, although I think it's an important thing that we need to think about. The court just decided this on a statutory basis. They basically said the statute that was used to criminalize this communication does not have a high enough intent requirement. It's not clear that Anthony Alonis intended to terrorize his wife. And so they kicked the case back, and the court is going to have to look at it again. For those of you who are cringing because what he wrote was really awful, I think that even under a higher intent requirement, he will still be penalized. He's already served his jail time. It's pretty clear that even if you bump up how much he had to intend to terrorize her, he probably meets that test. But it was a really missed opportunity, I think, for the court to, for the first time, engage with these questions of what does the First Amendment mean when our encounters are no longer face-to-face? And Justice Stephen Breyer a few years ago said, you may remember the Quran-burning pastor in Florida who was trying to inflame people to violence. And Justice Breyer said, with respect to that, the whole world is a crowded theater. We need to rethink our First Amendment doctrine in an era of online conversation. The court did not do that. And I should tell you, a lot of women's groups were very, very upset that the court didn't take more seriously the fact that the mere fear of violence is the harm here, not the violence itself. All right, there were a couple. I'm now well into where I wanted to be on this term, but I will just say the other two cases that are important, and they're important because last year we talked about Hobby Lobby and religious freedom. There were two religious freedom cases at the court last term. They both seemed kind of trivial, but they both were important. One was simply Abercrombie and Fitch. A young woman went into her interview at Abercrombie and Fitch. And if you're blinking at me, it's because, like, even I'm not hip enough to shop at Abercrombie and Fitch. It's like for 16-year-olds. But she wanted to sell clothes at this store that has what's called a looks policy. And the looks policy is you have to be young and preppy. And she was wearing hijab. She was wearing a Muslim headscarf. And she didn't get the position. And the question for the court was simply, whose burden is it? The person seeking the job or Abercrombie and Fitch's the interviewer to determine whether this is a religious accommodation she's seeking? And the court said, you know what, the burden is not on her to come in an interview and say, are you going to accommodate my headscarf? So the court, by an 8-1 margin, sided with the woman in the headscarf, that if you're going to discriminate, or if you're going to raise questions about whether a headscarf, a Muslim headscarf, can be part of your workplace gear, the burden is on the employer, not on the employee, to seek the accommodation. The other one was even sillier, and that had to do with a prisoner in the Arkansas prison system who wanted to grow a beard because his Muslim faith precluded him from shaving. And the Arkansas policy was you couldn't have a beard because you might have, like, razors and small cameras and, I don't know, chickens, and I don't know what they thought people were hiding in their beards. It only becomes a silly case because almost every other jurisdiction made accommodations for Muslim prisoners to have short beards. This was argued at the Supreme Court by Doug Laycock here at UVA, who's really, I think, one of the most important thinkers about religious freedom in the country. And a court 9-0 said, of course, he is owed this accommodation. And if you want to, writes Justice Alito in the majority opinion, you can certainly make him comb out his beard as part of inspection so the chickens and the razors can fall out. But we're not going to take away his religious freedoms. So just to sort of recap the big, big themes from last term, what you probably read last June was this is the most liberal term the court has had in decades, certainly under the auspices of the John Roberts Court. I think that's true, but it's not true. And so I want to just try to push back on that a little bit. I think the real takeaway from last term, and I know I've said this exact sentence to you before, is it's Anthony Kennedy's world and we all just live in it. And that really is the huge takeaway that you heard, right, as I was going through the major cases, 5-4, 5-4, 5-4, 5-4. In 14 of the 19 5-4 decisions, Anthony Kennedy is with the majority. So he just, where he goes, the court goes, and then the country goes. And I cannot emphasize enough what it means when you're looking down the barrel of an aging court and Anthony Kennedy about to turn 80 to have this one seat possibly filled by the next president, because he really is, and you see it every day at oral argument, I'm there watching. And it's like the only justice anyone sees is Anthony Kennedy, and the others are all potted plants because he is the decider. And we saw that more this term than we've seen it in a long, long time. I think it was clearly a winning term for the left wing of the court. The justice who was in the majority most of the time, 92% of the time, was Stephen Breyer, center-left pragmatist justice. But I think the other takeaway from last term is that a lot of the cases that came to the court probably shouldn't have been to the court in the first place. And so King versus Burwell, that Obamacare challenge, that shouldn't have been a Supreme Court case. That was a kind of a nutty op-ed, that established by the states should be used to gut an entire statute. Certainly there's a legal principle there, I guess. But the fact that this makes it all the way to the Supreme Court, I think, is really interesting. And I think it shows that there was a little bit of an overreach by some of the groups that are just determined to do away with the Affordable Care Act, that they thought that they might just pick off a fifth vote at the court. The fact that they only got three shows, I think, that the court doesn't want to carry water in these intensely political ideological fights. They're certainly willing to wade in a lot of places we may not want the court to wade in, but I don't think that they want to be the errand boys on some of these fights. And you could really see that in John Roberts' opinion in King versus Burwell. So the other thing that I flicked at earlier, but I think it's worth saying, is that this was the left wing of the court absolutely acting as a team. And we have not seen that in a long, long time. And this term, and it, I think, is a credit in, I will say this, to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is the senior justice on the left wing of the court. That means she's assigning opinions when the liberals are writing. And I think that she has said over and over again, we are going to write in one voice. We are not going to work against each other. There are only four of us. And she has really, I think, done, right or wrong, a job of making sure that the left aren't picking at each other. And I think the corollary to that we saw on the right side of the court this year, and this was a big change, is that the right wing of the court does not vote together as a block anymore. And in a lot of the cases I described to you earlier, we had Clarence Thomas jumping to vote with the left. We had, in some cases, Scalia voting to with the left. There was a major case on judicial speech where John Roberts hived off and voted with the left. And I think that what we've simply seen is some dissension on one wing of the court and much more cohesion on the other wing of the court. And whether that holds or not, I don't know. But I do think it's one worthy statistic that sort of is emblematic of this trend from last year, is that John Roberts Roberts and Clarence Thomas disagreed in one-third of their cases. So the agreement level on the right is actually decreasing. The agreement level on the left is increasing. And that, I think, is one of the things that we saw this year. The other theme at the end of last term that you probably heard was, whatever happened in 2015 is going to be completely different next year. And you'll remember, as the court was handing down marriage equality, as they were handing down Obamacare, they were accepting certiorari in affirmative action, in a union's fee case, in most likely they have to take one of two abortion cases. And so I think that to say that last year was a very, very winning case year for the left wing of the court obscures the fact that this year probably will not be. This year, I think we're going to see the court tack back to the right on a lot of really fundamental issues. And so I want to use the rest of my time, if I may, to just tee up some of the cases that are coming up, with the understanding that some of these the court has still not granted cert on, and so we just don't know what the entire docket is going to look like. Just one other tiny point of information. Last year, the court only heard 67 cases on the merits. When I started, not so long ago, 15 years ago covering the court, they were hearing 110. Not so long ago, they were hearing 150. So the docket is shrinking. The number of cases appealed up to the court obviously is exponentially bigger than it's ever been. The court is just not taking as many cases as it used to. And we can talk in the Q&A if you want to about why that's happening. But it means that there's a lot of urgent issues that don't get to the court at all. And that's a problem, to say the least. Okay, so just teeing up some of the big cases the court is going to hear this term. One big one is the challenge to the proposition that one person, one vote is the law of the land. So this was a signal decision. The decision that Earl Warren was proudest of in his career was a case called Reynolds versus Sims that had to do with voting apportionment. And in effect, until Reynolds versus Sims came along, you could have legislatures that were apportioned such that there were jurisdictions that had 91 people in it, and they had an equal vote to jurisdictions that had thousands of voters. And the court in Reynolds versus Sims says, no, from now on, it's going to be proportional to the number of people in a jurisdiction, one person, one vote. And the argument is, and it's a very novel argument, is that we should allocate votes by voters, not by people. And what that means, and this comes up out of Texas, get used to that, this comes out of Texas, I'm gonna say it four times in the next 20 minutes, but this is a case that comes out of Texas where the challenge is, we don't think it should be one person, one vote, because big cities are full of people who are immigrants or who have small children. It should be one voter, one vote, because otherwise the jurisdictions that have non-voters have elevated power over jurisdictions that have voters. And that's the argument. And in effect, really what they're saying is people in cities have too much say, and their residents are not citizens. Now, this is a problem for various textual reasons. Largely, the 14th Amendment talks about, you know, people, not voters. But more fundamentally, we just don't count voters. We don't have a number for that. The census is of people in a jurisdiction, not voters. So there's no good way to get a number for what that would look like. But if you loop back to what I said before about how I think John Roberts, in both of the ACA cases, has signaled that he does not want to do these experimental, political, partisan cases, this might be the kind of case that, even though it's got some real charm rhetorically and it's very interesting and the think tanks are really into it, it's challenging such a fundamental notion of how we allocate votes in this country and how we create legislative districts, that it's the kind of case I think he's going to balk at. I think he may not want to carry water for this one. And so it's very clear We've seen Clarence Thomas has written already in opinions that he wants this case. It's very clear there's probably three votes that are quite enamored of this as a legal proposition. It's not clear to me there are five, but it really bears watching because I think it's an example of using the courts to try to profoundly reshape how we allocate voting power. Another one that's so important that's not getting the attention it should has to do with financing of public sector unions. And this is a court called Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association. We've seen sort of the power of public sector unions whittled away at the court, but there is a case from 1970s called Abood that basically says you can certainly, if you don't want your money to go to a public sector union for partisan political speech, your First Amendment speech rights protect that. But you still have to pay for collective bargaining. Why? Because you have a free rider problem, right? If everybody says, well, I'm not paying for collective bargaining, but I'm sure going to be happy when someone does it on my behalf. So the court drew that line in Abood and said that you can use it. You can say, I decline to contribute to unions for political activities, but I cannot decline for collective bargaining. And again, this is a case where Justice Alito has written very strongly saying, bring me this case, because I don't see a difference from the First Amendment, pure First Amendment speech point of view, to say that you can withhold money for one purpose and not for the other. They're both speech. It's the same. So the net effect will be, I think it's pretty clearly, that if everybody can say, I don't want my money to be used for public sector, for collective bargaining purposes, it's going to be a huge blow to public sector unions. And we're seeing amicus brief after amicus brief being filed in this California case, more or less saying, we will not have public sector unions going forward if Friedrichs goes the way it looks like it's going to go. Affirmative action is coming back to the court. You probably remember, long before I started talking to you, in 2003, the Supreme Court decided in a pair of Michigan cases called Grutter that we can use race as a factor for college admissions and law school admissions in that case, as a factor in order to create diversity in the classroom. And this is Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, still on the court. She's saying, in her opinion in Grutter, she says, look, in 25 years, we're not going to need it anymore because we're going to be diverse. But for right now, in the interest of fostering diversity in education, we're going to allow race to be used. Well, O'Connor leaves the court and Sam Alito takes her place. And this is, right, a signal change. I've said this to you before. This, more than any other thing, changes how the court approaches particularly race cases. And so in 2013, there's a challenge that comes up through the University of Texas system. The University of Texas has a plan that's called a top 10% plan. What they do is they simply let in the top 10% of all high school students get into the UT system. Other candidates can apply and get in, but they're allowed admission through a holistic system that does take race into account. So this is not a challenge to top 10. This is the tier under that in Texas where students want to get in and race is a factor. In 2013, a young woman called Abigail Fisher challenges this plan. She gets to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court actually surprised everybody. I think we would have said in 2013 that this was the end of affirmative action in higher education. One thing is that Elena Kagan is recused from this case, so there's eight justices deciding this because she was Solicitor General and worked on it. But the case sort of surprised everybody, because the court, by a 7-1 margin, kicks it back to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeal in Texas and says, look at it again. We're not sure. Make sure you're using the highest level of scrutiny, strict scrutiny, to determine if using race is okay. And the Fifth Circuit surprises everybody by coming back and saying, yeah, we think this use of race in this context is still all right. It's all right under that Grutter case, the Michigan case. We're gonna sign off on this affirmative action plan. Supreme Court takes it back again last spring. So this looks like having the Texas court having blessed this plan, it looks like the court is reaching out to take it to say, you know, the court doesn't take things that they think are correctly decided. So it looks as though the court is taking this in order to, this time, do away with affirmative action. Now I'm just going to stop for 2 minutes of gossip, because, right, that's why we're here. When the Fisher case came to the court in 2013, Sonia Sotomayor wrote what she thought was going to be a dissent in that case. And it was a dissent in which she was writing and expressing what it is to be a Latina and American today, and why we're not over race, and why this isn't post-racial America, and why we still need to be aware of race. And she circulated it. And the justices all seemed to change their votes, and they said, you know what, we're okay, let's send it back to Texas. And it didn't get published as a dissent. Well, interestingly, that dissent, you may recall, 2 years ago, was published in a different case, in a Michigan case, that had only tangentially to do with affirmative action. But she wrote it. She said that was her dissent in a case called Schutte, and she basically repurposed that dissent and said, it still sucks to be a Latina in America, and we're still not over race, and here's what it's like. So to the extent that she moved the needle a little bit in 2013, when the court was thinking about how it wanted to deal with affirmative action, it'll be interesting to see if having a woman of color write something like that this time around again will have any impact. I think it's fair to say this is Kennedy's country, and we all live in it. I think Anthony Kennedy will be the one who determines in Fisher whether we have affirmative action going forward in higher education. Okay, two other quickies. I think this is the year that the court has to deal with abortion again. It seems almost inevitable that the court has kicked away case after case after case, but there are two big abortion cases that the court has had, believe it or not, for months in conference and still not taken one of them. But I think it's absolutely clear that Texas's HB 2, which is the big, you'll remember the huge sweeping Texas abortion law that Wendy Davis protested, that case that comes out of Texas, I think now we stand to close more than half of the clinics in Texas if that law is allowed to go into effect. And so there are real questions, I think, about whether going forward, if we really have to close most of the clinics in a lot of the states that have these provisions, then the court, I think, can't duck it anymore. The two issues in this is called Whole Women's Health versus Cole. This is the Texas case. The two issues in the Texas law that are being challenged are, one, doctors have to have admitting privileges in order to perform abortions. They have to have admitting privileges in local hospitals. And what that has meant in practical terms is that if local hospitals will not give a doctor admitting privileges, his clinic, his practice shuts down, and that's what we've seen happen. And the other is that any abortion clinic in the state of Texas had to be retrofitted to become an ambulatory surgical center, so that even though you don't need hallways wide enough to have, say, two gurneys pass each other, you have to retrofit your hallways so that two gurneys can pass each other. And you have to have massive surgical suites. And needless to say, these clinics can't comply with those rules. And so we're seeing clinics shut down. Now, just briefly, if you remember Roe v. Wade, which is then subsumed by Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992, the test is supposed to be, we cannot put a, quote, undue burden on the mother. But nobody knows, in classic Sandra Day O'Connor draftsmanship, nobody knows what undue burden means. And so this test, this Texas case, really becomes a test of, if there are no clinics in the entire Rio Grande Valley and women have to drive 400 miles and there's a 72-hour waiting period and then they have to drive another 400 miles, might that be an undue burden? And the Fifth Circuit said no. The Fifth Circuit had no problem with these provisions. And so really, in a surprise, I think, to a lot of people, in June, the U.S. Supreme Court actually issued an injunction that stopped this law from going into effect. Five justices, Kennedy and the liberals, said we're not going to get in a situation where we shut down every clinic while this case is pending. So they issued an injunction, so the laws did not go into effect. But those are the two questions that are in Cole coming up to the court. The other one that the court may take, if they don't want to take such a huge, broad, dramatic one, is Currier versus Jackson. And this is a Mississippi admitting privileges law. It would have the effect, if it goes into effect, of closing the only clinic left in Mississippi. This was actually signed off. The Fifth Circuit actually said, no, this is unconstitutional. It is an undue burden. So one or the other, I think it really is impossible for the court not to take it. That said, everyone I know has been on high alert since last March, waiting for the court to tell us they were going to take one of these, and they still have not. There's a slew of criminal cases on the docket this year, really an unbelievable amount of criminal cases, which I think tells you that that's just interesting to the court right now. There's a slew of class action cases, including one that was heard this week that had to do with the Tyson's pork slaughter factory and how we create classes for class action purposes. The last case that the court just granted cert on is the Hobby Lobby 2.0. And so I want to just close by telling you about this because I think it's a big, big deal. You'll remember 2 years ago when the court decided Hobby Lobby, what they said was a for-profit employer, in this case a craft store, owned by religious owners, can say that they will not honor the contraception mandate in the Affordable Care Act if it violates their religious convictions. And so in that case, you had the Green family in the Conestoga case, and you had the Hobby Lobby, the owners of Hobby Lobby saying, we just can't supply our employees with the morning after pill, with Ella, Plan B, certain devices, because they're abortifacients. We think our religion tells us they cause abortions, and we're not going to let that be part of the bundle of things that we give them, despite the fact that Obamacare says they're entitled to this. And you'll remember, because we probably talked about it last year, 5-4 at the very end of two terms ago, the Supreme Court says, you know what, their religious freedom kind of trumps here. And one of the reasons that the court signs off on the Hobby Lobby deal is because the Obama administration had created a workaround. They had created a workaround for the not-for-profits. And what they said is, we have an exemption. If you are a religious-affiliated hospital or school, you don't have to provide your employees with contraception that you object to religiously. You just have to fill out a form saying that you object. Or you can write a letter. They even amended their accommodation. You just have to write a letter to HHS and say, these are the things we can't cover. And then the insurer goes back and forth with the administration to get it covered. So the reason, one of the principal reasons, in addition to religious freedom, that Alito, in his majority opinion in Hobby Lobby, signs off on allowing this to go forward is because there's this exemption. This challenge is to the exemption. So this says, having said, all you have to do is fill out a form, religiously affiliated employers don't want to fill out the form. Why? Not unreasonably, they say it triggers an abortion. So if I check the box on the form that says, well, I object to covering, you know, Ella or Plan B or the IUD, then it goes back to the insurer. The insurer gets it for them. So I have triggered, that's the word they use, an abortion. So it's the same thing, whether I fill out the form or I provide the contraception. And these are very sympathetic groups. That one of the groups in the case, you know, is the Little Sisters, right? This is an amazing group of nuns who provide amazing, incredible care. And what they say is, we simply can't, our religious conscience does not allow us to do this. So we won't do the form, and we won't even write the letter. And we can't, because it violates our, every time we check that box, our religious conscience is violated. And so every single court that had looked at one of these seven courts of appeals had looked at a case like this and said, no, we're sorry, check the box. Like, you know, this is not a burden on your religious freedom. And then just very, very recently, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals voted on the side of the religious nonprofits and said this is a religious burden. And so that now the court last week took the case and said, now we have to hear it. And it's a really interesting problem because this is exactly the fix that the court said allowed Hobby Lobby to go forward. Now the fix is the problem, and the court has to determine if the fix is also the problem. So it's a brain twister, but this will be heard most likely in March or April. And I just want to be clear, because I think it's a little bit been misreported, that this is not a First Amendment case. This is a statutory case. It's a case that comes up under RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And so it's not a constitutional case. It's interpreting this statute and what a burden is on your religious freedoms under this statute. But this court, and we said this last year when we talked about this, fractured so profoundly on Hobby Lobby, where the men were on one side, the women were on the other, and Breyer, you know, the Catholics were on one side, the Jews, and the lapsed Catholic were on the other. So this is one of those, that would be Sotomayor. But, you know, this is just one of those cases that is really hard to unbraid the ideology of the justices from who they are, their stories, their faiths, and their genders. And it's the kind of case that the court hates for that very reason, because it really smokes out these things, these identity questions that are very, very difficult for them to reckon with. So I'm going to just close by saying, and I'm sorry, I feel like I went a little long, but I'm just going to close by saying that really this is an amazing moment, because we have four justices, three who are about to turn 80, one who is 83, and a presidential race that almost certainly will determine maybe one, maybe two, maybe four seats on this court. And that is truly extraordinary. And I would be remiss if I didn't tell you that Ted Cruz is saying we should institute judicial elections for the Supreme Court because they're out of control. And if not judicial elections, at least retention elections. Ben Carson is saying we should just do away with judicial review altogether and just pretend Marbury versus Madison never happened, and, you know, Supreme Court decisions can be advisory. You know, on the other end of the spectrum, Bernie Sanders is saying that he will have a litmus test, and he will not, if elected president, put anyone on the court unless they pledge to overturn Citizens United from 2010. So we're talking crazy talk about the court, and it worries me. It worries me that we're not having a sophisticated and thoughtful and nuanced conversation about the court. We should not be barnstorming and putting forward bananas ideas, and yet I think on both sides we really are. And so I would just urge you, before I take questions, to really give a lot of thought to whether the court it really is going to continue to be like number 13 and 14 on our list of things we worry about when we elect a president, because, you know, I think it should be one or two. So I thank you so much for your amazing patience and indulgence, and I'm totally happy to take questions.
Amazingly informative and consistently entertaining. Thank you so much. Now, we've got time for some questions and answers. In fact, we got plenty of time, and you can still make your son's
good. Pickup. Outstanding. All right.
All right. But you have to
Mike?
Raise your hand, and we go around.
I think there's
the
a mic. Yeah.
Because we have a podcast system.
Oh, dear. Okay.
Okay, so we've got one back there.
I'm taking back the thing I said about bananas. If we're podcasting.
Why? All right. We always enjoy having you come and informing us so well and entertaining us at the same time, I think. But my question is, why is the Supreme Court taking fewer courses now than they used to? If it's because they're old, I can relate to that.
That's a great question, and there's a lot of theories, and some of them are grand and some of them are not grand. I think the really easy answer to that is that Justice Bill Brennan used to always say, what is the single most important constitutional doctrinal rule in history, to his new clerks? And they'd be like, oh, you know, the Commerce Clause, or, you know, they'd be, you know, 14th Amendment. And he'd be like, no, five. Getting to five. That's the only thing you need to know, is that you need to get five votes, and that's how you win cases. And I think one of the reasons that we have a little bit of a backlog is because it only takes four votes to grant a case, but five to get the court to do what you want. And so there's an enormous amount of defensive voting when it comes to taking cases. So it's kind of the inversion of what I said about Justice Kennedy. Unless you know that you have Kennedy on side, and in a lot of these areas, you know, affirmative action, abortion, a lot of the church-state cases, these religious freedom cases, I don't think either side completely knows that they have five votes. And so it really is easier to just knock them away and hope that you don't have to deal. So that's the sort of big picture answer. There is a kind of an in-the-weeds technical answer that's kind of interesting, and that is just this. For most of history, each of the justices in their own chambers decided whether they were going to grant a case, they would hear a case or not. That changed, and now they have what's called a cert pool. And it means that all of the clerks for all of the chambers only look at each case, only one clerk looks at each case, and they pool their resources so that, because, right, there's thousands of cases. At one level, it makes sense. You can't ask your chamber to split, you know, 4,000 cases and determine if you're going to grant. But what it means is that where you used to have, you know, Justice Marshall's chambers looked at every case, Justice Brennan's, you know, Justice Rehnquist's, now you have a world in which everybody's pooling their clerks. Every case gets one set of eyeballs, and clerks are the most risk-averse people in the world. They don't want to take a case and look stupid, and so there's a huge incentive to not take cases. And I think that one of the things that Justice Alito decided a few years ago was to pull out of the cert pool. And so his chambers actually looks at every cert petition, and that's why, because this is just groupthink. And it's a huge, huge problem, I think, to not have serious scrutiny in every single chamber of every single case. So those are sort of at different levels of abstraction, different answers. I don't think it's because they're too old or they're too busy. I think that this happens to be a court that is in perfect equipoise. There's four and four and one in the middle. You got that, right? Because I've said it 400 times. There's four and four and one in the middle. And I think people
first,
are very anxious.
Piece of news. My phone made a noise just as you were ending your speech. The court agreed to take the Texas case.
Wow. It's like we're magic in here. Well, I guess I need to go home and write, and someone else will pick up my son. Okay. That's great.
Okay.
Good. I won't be sleeping tonight.
You pointed out the ages of the justices. What do you think is the prospects? Which ones are most likely
to retire?
Yes.
Well, there's an actuarial part of that question, which is just, you know, who's older. And we've talked about, I think, in this group before about, you know, why Justice Ginsburg didn't retire. She clearly wants to be replaced by a Democrat president, and she simply chose, in the face of an enormous amount of pressure in the last 2 years, she just chose not to step down. So I think she would have been the most obvious candidate. But like I said, Justices Scalia and Kennedy are both going to be 80 next year. Justice Breyer is 78. Then there's kind of a gap, and there's younger justices. In one sense, it only matters if a Democrat is elected president and a conservative justice retires, or if a Republican is elected president and a Democrat retires. That's when you're going to see, you know, sort of the apocalypse. And then if Kennedy retires, it's just, you know, we just go in your basement and I'll tell you when to come out, because that's going to be horrific. But I think that, you know, if the question is which are the of these people are most apt to time a retirement to having somebody in office that they agree with, I think the answer is all of them. I don't think any of them wants to be replaced by someone that they don't agree with. I think one of the sort of ironies of this court is that you're not allowed to say that until you retire. And then the minute you retire, like Justice Stevens, John Paul Stevens recently said, well, of course you time your retirement to coincide with a president that you agree with. But it's seen as bad form to say that while you're still on the bench. And so I think the answer is any of those four. And then, you know, I think this is the gossip part again, but, you know, Justice Scalia, like, drinks a bottle of wine and smokes a cigar every day. That guy's going to live forever. I mean, he is just, you know, the most robust human in the world. And the other piece of that is I'm often asked, although never in this crowd, you know, is Ruth Bader Ginsburg really as completely fragile as she looks? And why, by the way, does she keep falling asleep at the State of the Union? To which I think she bravely answered this year, because I was drunk. So, you know, she's like, oh, I just fell asleep because I had a bottle of wine before, which you can take as ever you want to take that. But I think that Ginsburg, you know, who's a two-time cancer survivor, and is certainly does not look like the most robust human that has ever walked the face of the earth. And when people ask me, you know, is she really as frail as she looks? My answer is, you know, I think she looked like that when she was 37. I mean, she's not just not a muscular, vigorous person. And that said, you know, she and Elena Kagan have the same trainer at the court, and she can bench press more than Kagan can. So she's doing all right.
From things that I've read and people that I've heard speak, consistently say that the longer someone serves on the court, the more likely it is that they move to the middle. And I'd like to hear what you think about that.
It's a great question. There's certainly, I think, you know, recent history suggests that, you know, John Paul Stevens, who, you know, clearly, I think, started at the center right of the court, moved to the far left of the court. The same, I think, is certainly true of David Souter. You know, so you have people who come on as sort of moderate, and I think O'Connor's probably an example of that. And Kennedy, I think, increasingly looks like an example of that. And there are far fewer examples of people who start, you know, on the far left of the court and moderate themselves toward the center. So it tends to be to work in one way from the right to the center and not as much from the left to the center. I mean, there's lots of answers for why that happens. Justice Stevens' answer is it has nothing to do with human nature. It's simply, he would say, the court moved around me. I started, you know, at the center of the court, and by the time I left the court, the people who were on the left of me were dead and never to be replaced by anyone like them. The people who were to the right of me were considered the radical left, and the people, then there was this group of people put to the right of them that, you know, I don't recognize. And so he always said the court kind of torqued around him. He didn't move. I think O'Connor would tell you that as life goes on and you have experiences and you have a depth of knowledge and understanding, you do evolve closer to the center. You know, Clarence Thomas famously has said, like, I am not evolving. And so he wants it to be patently clear to everybody that he's not drifting anywhere. So I think it seems to me like it's such a justice specific inquiry, but I think the trend is certainly exactly as you describe it, that, you know, a lot of people that came onto the court had moved, you know, to the center. And I think, you know, one story I love to tell, I hope I didn't tell it to you last year, but, you know, Chief Justice Bill Rehnquist, who wrote right before he died sort of the seminal case on the Family Medical Leave Act with this profound sensitivity to what it is to be a single mother of a child and have that child be ill and what it means to have to take time off. And it was, what? Rehnquist? What? And I interviewed Justice Ginsburg and asked her a version of this question, you know, how do people change? And she told me that when her husband, Bernard, was reading that Rehnquist opinion in their apartment the day it came down, he sort of barked at her. You have to imagine the Brooklyn accent, which I will not attempt, but he was like, Ruthie, did you write this? Like, he couldn't believe, like, he thought she'd ghostwritten it for him. And, you know, like, what? Bill Rehnquist, you know, this sort of rock-ribbed Republican. And you know, she says, and I think, you know, that his entirety of his views on, you know, women and labor and the need to take time off and employers changed when his daughter got divorced and had to raise kids. And suddenly he was like completely of a different view. And so she sort of likes to say, you know, everybody, if they're open-hearted and they listen to each other, will kind of gravitate to a middle place. And she profoundly believes that. And I do think that one of the things that we don't always appreciate, because we think of the court as like just a big mud wrestling pit, but I do think that when they go into conference and they talk to each other, and in cases like that really sort of share experience. I mean, remember what I said about Sotomayor writing about race, you know, the court backed off on affirmative action. So I think that they can persuade each other, but I think it's very, very difficult to persuade each other because this court is very, very polarized right now.
Hi, and thank you for a wonderful talk, very engaging. I'm curious to know, I know it's not on the docket, but is there anything working its way forward that might have some mitigating action on the freedom of super PACs?
It's a great question. I think there's always a case out there. There's certainly nothing that I see coming up to challenge Citizens United. You know, you'll remember 2 years ago the court heard McCutcheon, which was, you know, the millionaires exception to Citizens United, and further, you know, sort of winnowed away at campaign finance rules. I think until the composition of the court changes, the Citizens United is going to be the law of the land. And I think that's why it's just going to be really important, if we think that that matters, to do something either, you know, people talk about constitutional amendments or legislative fixings. But I think that it's pretty clear, because the court had a chance to revisit it in McCutcheon. And, you know, this was a good example of a case where, you know, Justice Kennedy, who took a lot of heat for his opinion in Citizens United, that said, unless it's quid pro quo corruption, you know, we don't have a problem, and it doesn't inflect on voter confidence. And when McCutcheon came around and he had an opportunity to look at that again, I think a lot of people had thought, huh, maybe having seen how this played out, you know, in an election cycle, the court might rethink it, but the court kind of doubled down. So I actually think the fixes to campaign finance are going to happen legislatively, if at all. And I think it's why Bernie Sanders says that that's his litmus test. He's not putting someone on the court unless they vote to reverse it. You know, the only other thing I would say, just as a point of interest, was that last year there was a case, I didn't talk about it, but it was like the next one on my list if I'd have gotten to it, that had to do with judicial speech in elections. So it's not about campaign finance directly, but it was about judges dialing for dollars and judges running for election who pick up the phone and shake people down for money. And some judges in Florida challenging this and saying, you know, that there was a restriction on that, and saying this is the same as Citizens United. This is free speech. And this is a case where John Roberts jumps and votes with the liberals and says, oh, but when it's judicial speech, it's different from political speech, because some inexorable, unknowable reason that he doesn't tell us. So it is interesting, you know, that we've seen in a lot of these cases that the court draws a line at money equals speech between judges and politicians. And we saw Kennedy do it in one case in Caperton, and then we saw John Roberts do it last year. And so for some reason, the court's willing to say, you can get five people on the court to say, when it has to do with judges and money and elections, that's bad. But when it's politicians, it's speech. And we, you know, so I think to the extent that we try to see that as tea leaves for movement on Citizens United, I think it's optimistic, but it is certainly interesting.
Thank you again for your presentation today. I just have a brief question which refers to one of your colleagues, editorially had within the last week or so, Adam,
Adam Liptak.
Yes.
Oh, God. Yeah. What did he say now?
I'm sorry. Well, what his hypothesis seemed to be, and I think he was referring to a study done by Professor Lazarus at Harvard, was to the effect that, and you mentioned Justice Kennedy and the work he had done over the past session. The notion in this particular article seemed to be that there was a quid pro quo between the chief and Justice Kennedy, in that Kennedy or the chief would let Kennedy write the majority decision if he would line up on the right side, or words to that effect. I mean, that's my vague recollection of it.
Yeah. Yes? I think the piece was about how the chief is using his assignment power strategically, right?
Yes.
And I think he was saying he is. This is, you know, the Chief Justice has one power other than, you know, he gets to turn the lights off at the end of the day. He doesn't have a lot of more power than the other justices, but his one power is he doles out writing assignments. And I think Adam's point was that he has certainly been using his assignment power to bring Kennedy on board and, you know, other justices when they're, you know, on the edge. And I think I would just say, you know, that was the same thing that Chief Justice Rehnquist did and Berger did and Warren did. This is a great power. And by the way, it's the thing that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is doing in dissent, you know, when she's handing out minority opinions, because it goes to the next senior justice in the minority. So I think that it's certainly true that it would be naive to suggest that whoever's handing out assignments isn't doing it completely tactically. It's depressing because one likes to believe that they just, you know, spin a wheel and give it out based on fairness. But I think that John Roberts is many, many things. And I think chief among them is he's a very, very strategic, long game thinker.
I wondered if you have any prognostications about whether the court will take up Obama's immigration case coming up.
I think they have to now. I think, you know, so this is the Fifth Circuit decision that just came down that effectively kept the nationwide injunction on DACA, the provision of the immigration reform that allowed the family of dreamers, kids called dreamers, to not be deported. And it was an interesting case because the Fifth Circuit slow walked that. They had they were under orders to fast track that appeal. They were supposed to take it within 60 days, to decide it in 60 days. It took over 4 months. And then it came down 2-1, keeping the injunction in place, citing against the Obama administration. Solicitor General, there was certainly a lot of whispering that they slow walked it deliberately. In fact, the dissenting judge in that case says that it's unseemly that they kept it as long as they kept it, but that part of the reason was that it would not get heard on Obama's watch, that it was deliberately stalled so that it would not get decided until Obama was out of office. I do know the Solicitor General is running as we speak to get that filed in the court so that it can be heard this term. Whether it will be heard this term or not, it will be heard. I think there's no better candidate for a case that has to go to the Supreme Court. But I think that the really interesting part of it is the political valence, that this was a almost purely political issue. There's not a great constitutional or legal question here, but that the political act of timing it so that it doesn't happen until after Obama's out of office is something I haven't seen before. It's fascinating. So it's coming, and you know, probably not this term.
Yeah, there's lots in the news these days about corporations tending to have people sign contracts where they're required to do arbitration as opposed to class action suits. Is the court going to do something about that, or
they every time they've done it, they've been on the side of the corporations.
Will they do that again this year? Likely.
I don't think there's a case. I'm trying to think of if there's one directly on that point. You know, the big one was the AT&T versus Concepcion case, and that was when the court really did say that you can force consumers into arbitration rather than litigation. But the court has pretty consistently held that all of those non-litigation policies are in effect. And the court has also, you know, most recently in the Walmart class action suit, decided that you can unbundle a class of complaining workers and say that they can't bring a class action. And the Tyson's chicken, I guess pork, the Tyson's meat case from this week is also one of four class action cases at the court. But there's no question that the trend has been to be strongly in favor of dismantling the power to bring class action suits, and also strongly in favor of arbitration over actual litigation.
Are those votes 5-4 typically?
Yeah.
Listen, we have time for one more very important question. Who has it? Lady right
no
here.
No pressure.
But in the Ohlone's case, do you believe that the court found that Ohlone's conduct did not arise to the level of intent to kill his wife because of the distance between them, six states?
No. It wasn't the intent question was whether he intended to kill her. It was whether he intended to threaten her.
Oh, okay, right. So, same thing.
So,
though.
Yeah, I think that they simply felt that the standard, which was something closer to knowledge rather than you know purpose to threaten, wasn't high enough. So they didn't really, I think, dig down into what his intent was. They simply said it's not enough that a reasonable juror listening to this would have thought she would reasonably feel threatened. That's too low. What it has to be is that he intended in some fashion to threaten her. And so it changed, right? It ratcheted it up. But I don't think that they were in any way rooted in the facts of the case. And I think a lot of the people who bitterly resented that decision felt, you know, what your implication is, which was, oh, she was scared, and so was, you know, the FBI agent he threatened to kill, and the other people, you know, were reasonably scared. That wasn't, the court wasn't asking that question. They were asking what the jury thought.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you all so much. Have a good weekend.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.